Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Well, we're nearing a conclusion for chapter 12. Of Canto 10. Chapter 12, Canto 10 is Krishna's killing of the Agasura demon. He hasn't killed him yet. What just happened, we just had this super long commentary from Bhagavat Sandarbha on Krishna becoming... Krishna has all potencies. One of the terms is satya sankalpa shakti. That is, anything he wants to do, it happens. He doesn't have to do anything more than just want it to happen, and it happens. Satya sankalpa. It just becomes a fact. And his satya sankalpa, it looks like, but it's not really, looks like it's satya sankalpa shakti drew a blank. It just didn't happen. Something he wanted, the opposite happened. That was, the cowherd boys entered the mouth of the Agasura demon. And the calves, both of which are very, very dear to Krishna. He didn't want it to happen, but it happened. And he was then, two additional things. He was amazed at his own Leela Shakti and how his own Leela Shakti was making arrangements even different than what he wanted. But it was for a purpose, and the purpose was enjoyment. That's what Leela means. It's pastime or play. He's just enjoying the moment of being uncertain what to do. It's not that even Krishna has his moments. It's that we have our moments because Krishna has his moments. As above, so below. So, but his not knowing what to do is different than our not knowing what to do. In his case, it's a pastime. In our case, it's we really don't know what to do. We're covered by ignorance, but Krishna's not. Sometimes his devotees become astonished, and sometimes he becomes astonished as a way of enjoying his loving relation with the cowherd boys. And that the very next moment that Leela Shakti influence upon Krishna shifted, and he knew what to do. So that's where we are. It's text 31, 10, 12, 31. Where, wait a minute. Sorry about that. It's 10, 12. Now, translation reads, now, what was to be done? How can he both kill this demon and save the devotees? How could they be performed simultaneously? Krishna, being unlimitedly potent, decided to wait for an intelligent means by which he could simultaneously save the boys and kill the demon. Then he entered the mouth of Agasura. Now, this is Prabhupada's translation. So, it tells us something if we're not really certain. Sometimes we need to pause and wait for the intelligence to know how to achieve this and that simultaneously. That's the practical application. But for Krishna, it's a pastime. Krishna is known as Ananta virya sarvagya, because everything is known to him. Because he knows everything perfectly well, it was not difficult for him to find a means by which he could save the boys and at the same time kill the demon. Thus, he also decided to enter the demon's mouth. So he had a plan. And it worked. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes in his commentary, "What should I do in this dangerous situation? How can I at once kill the demon without harming the boys?" Thinking in this way and finding a solution, he entered the mouth of the serpent because he is one who knows what to do in the present and future, Ashesha Drik, and he takes away, Hari, danger for the devotees and life for the demons. And Jiva Goswami comments, "Now, what was to be done? The rascal demon should not live and the boy should not die. How to do both simultaneously?" Thinking about this and understanding the solution, the attractive Lord, who saw the perfect method, entered the mouth of Agasura. Krishna saw the perfect way, Ashesha Drik, to enjoy pastimes and to liberate the demon, to protect the devotees and destroy the rascals. Or, he saw the unlimited calves and boys. He then entered the snake because he was overcome with affection by seeing their condition. He is called Hari because he would remove their suffering and attract their minds. There's a very short section from Brihat Bhagavatamrita. Are you too familiar with what that is? Brihat Bhagavatamrita is a book written by Sanatana Goswami. You know who is Sanatana Goswami? One of the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, followers of Lord Chaitanya. Rupa and Sanatan Goswamis are chief. The elder brother is Sanatan, and he wrote what might be considered a commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam. Commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam. So, he writes, "I worship the pastimes Krishna performed in the early mornings when he entered the Vrindavan forest with his calves and friends. Most relishable pastimes, such as entering the mouth of a great serpent after pondering in various ways." And the commentary reads, this is Sanatan Goswami's commentary of his book. "On what began as a typical cow grazing morning, the mighty demon Agas, in the form of a giant snake," was 8 miles long, that's pretty big, "confronted Krishna's cowherd friends." The boys, having decorated themselves with festive forest attire, were in a very playful mood. After amusing themselves by stealing one another's lunch bags and teasing the monkeys and other animals, they were looking for another game when they spotted Agha lying on the path with his gaping mouth, inviting them to enter. Krishna watched helplessly as they marched into the demon's mouth, and he began to think, quote, "Now what is to be done? How can both the killing of this demon and the saving of the devotees be performed simultaneously?" Krishna, being unlimitedly potent, decided to wait for an intelligent means by which he could simultaneously save the boys and kill the demon. Then he entered the mouth of Agasura. These pastimes are filled with all the different rasas of loving exchange, and thus They enchant the heart of whoever hears them. Text 29. When Krishna entered the mouth of Agastya, the demigods hiding behind the clouds exclaimed, "Alas! Alas!" But the friends of Agastya, like Kamsa and other demons, were jubilant. Commentary. There's nothing Prabhupada wrote here. Vishwanath writes, "The devatas, who were hiding in the clouds out of fear of Kamsa, began shouting, fearing Krishna's safety. Though the devatas are aware of the Lord's powers, because they are also devotees, they shouted in anxiety. The very nature of bhakti is to have affection. And the very nature of affection is to lose one's logical discriminatory powers. Kamsa and the Rakshasas," the Sanskrit phrase is Kona Pa, that's eater of corpses. "The sons and brothers of Agha rejoiced on hearing the news from messengers." And the messengers explains shortly, there are spies. What's going to happen? The spies reported back. Jiva Goswami writes, "The devatas hid behind the cloud because of fear of Kamsa and Agha. The word cha indicates other sinful people as well. Though Kamsa was a daitya demon, he was also a rakshasa. There are others considered the same here to indicate their extremely evil nature. They were all overjoyed, since by nature they hated the Lord. Glee arose within their evil minds. They became joyful because Kamsa heard about Agha swallowing the boys and Krishna through spies who had arrived in Vraja." And text 30. "When the invincible Supreme Personality Godhead Krishna heard the demons crying, 'Alas, alas,' from behind the clouds, he immediately enlarged himself within the demon's throat just to save himself and the cowherd boys, his own associates, from the demon who wished to smash them." Prabhupada's purport. Such are the acts of Krishna. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya traduskatam. You know the verse? You do. Good. Kind of? You do. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, text number 8. By enlarging himself within the throat of the demon, Krishna suffocated and killed him, and at the same time saved himself and his associate from imminent death, and also saved the demigods from lamentation. He did several things at one time. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes, "Hearing the sounds of dismay from the devatas and the sounds of rejoicing from the demons, Krishna then expanded his form in the throat of the snake who tried to swallow him into his stomach and digest him and the other boys. Krishna did this to reverse sounds of the lamentation of the devas and the sounds of rejoicing of the demons." Don't let the ones that are rejoicing do the opposite. In the pastime of killing Shakatasura, Trinavarta, and getting bound up, Krishna remained in a very small form and spread his powers. Therefore, in the throat of Agastya, he expanded his form to show that he did not lack the power to expand himself in size. In the Damodar and other pastimes, the Lord maintained his small form, suitably, because the devotees could taste in that form the full sweetness, and without that, the astonishment caused by a show of power with no disturbance to the conception of Krishna as their child. But here, in the absence of the two parents who were relishing the sweetness, he, being the Lord, took the more common method of just expanding himself to kill the demon. There's this constant interplay, a dynamic of sweetness and opulence, Madhurya and Aishwarya. And in Krishna's Brajalila, of course, he's the source of everything, so he has both capacities. And he discriminates when to show sweetness and when to show majesty. But here his parents, the elders who look upon him as their darling little boy, weren't around. So he showed his opulence. And the coward boys go, wow, that was really good. Let's go have lunch. So, according to different rasas, Krishna does different things. Last commentary, Jiva Goswami writes, when he heard the shouts of the devatas, Krishna expanded himself in the throat of the demon who wanted to crush him and the boys by shutting his mouth and rolling his body about. He expanded his body to a big size like a spike in order to plug the throat of the demon so that his mouth would stay open and he would die. He could do this because he was Bhagavan, full of all powers, and he did not decrease in power, avyaya. Thus, all fear of failure was removed. Again, why did he expand himself? He does this, he does not allow dissipation of his devotees, avyaya. He did it to protect his devotees. The reason is that he is Krishna, whose heart is attracted, Krish, by the devotees. In the morning session, we were discussing a little bit about the commentary from Bhagavat Sandarbha, a writing that explains in detail who is Bhagavan and how to understand him and how his potencies work and so on. And we heard about the arising from himself, his mystic powers. It says there's 8 primary and 10 secondary mystic powers. So one of those 8 primary mystic powers is Mahima Siddhi. He can become really big. Really big or really heavy, or both. That's what he did. He used that same Mahima Siddhi when Trinavarta was trying to carry him away. He just became heavier and heavier and couldn't carry him away. So he was holding on to his neck and he just crashed down on the ground. Fell on a stone slab and kaput, finished. So becoming heavy or becoming big. Now, the serpent also had mystic power. Demons can also have mystic power. Ravana had lots of mystic power. And this serpent, he became 8 miles long. That's, who can do that? Or, I think I'll spend a little bit of time, just because it's fun. Here's the 8 mystic cities by name and then explaining what they are briefly. The one that's become tiny, 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 very small, like a tiny particle. That one is Anima. smaller than the smallest, as Prabhupada would sometimes say. Anima. Okay, mahima, bigger than the biggest, or heavier than the heaviest. Then, very light. Starts with an L. Lagima. You know, floating in the air, riding on a magic carpet. You know that one. Or levitating. Lagima. So what we heard in the morning, Jiva Goswami was explaining these first three are having to do with the body. The body, the appearance of the body. Big, small, light. Then there's five more. Prapti Siddhi, obtaining something from a distant place. Creating something wonderful or annihilating something at will, like creating a planet. Can you think of a yogi that did this? Vishvamitramuni? Right? It's mystic power. Ishita. Controlling the material elements, doesn't detail what that means. Vashishtva Siddhi. Prakamya Siddhi is the power to fulfill any desire you want. Never be frustrated in fulfilling the desires you want. Whew. Material, of course. And then shape-changing cities. Kama vasayita. So the Rakshasas well, not only the Rakshasas, the Vanaras in Ramayana, they had such powers. Maricha and the Vanaras, both, the good guys and the bad guys, it's a mystic power. So when people don't know about mystic powers, they go, oh, fairy tale. But it's a mystic power. And demons can have mystic power, just like Agha, but match the mystic power of Agha against the mystic power of Krishna, who wins. So as Krishna was expanding himself to become bigger, bigger, he's a serpent. He's just a python. His body comes bigger, bigger. But Krishna was bigger than his bigger. So he suffocated. Something that Krishna wanted was not just to kill Agha, it was to liberate Agha. Because when Krishna does such things, it's not out of malice or, oh yeah, you're going to do that, or I'll show you, I'm going to get back. It's not like that mentality. It in fact, the pastime was orchestrated. It was said that by Krishna's yogamaya potency, he called Agha to come. Krishna's yogamaya potency called Agha to come because Krishna wants to liberate you, so please come. So there's a pastime that looked like danger, but there was no danger. How can there be danger? And Krishna wanted to enjoy that experience of being bewildered what to do, and then, so he did that for a bit. It can be kind of, you know, one that doesn't have bhakti can hear these explanations and go, oh, you people are silly. Not only you're believing in mythology, but you make all these twisted, convoluted explanations of why it's cool. just to like, you know, celebrate Krishna. Go live in your fairy tale story land, and we're going to do real stuff. It's only through bhakti that one can understand even anything about spiritual truth. Let's just take the soul. I've thought about this a lot. You know, in religions of the world, they'll agree there's a soul. I mean, there's some that don't, but they'll agree that there's a soul. What's the understanding of what the soul is? That's a very diverse set of answers you get. Yeah, you know, try it sometime when you meet different people with different ideologies, and what's their understanding of the soul? And, you know, the goal, the objective of the soul, and how to get there. Very different. And then, moreover, do they live their life that way? I'm spirit soul. We live our life as if we're the body. And doing things that meet the demands and needs of the body, and that's, we just do it nice. And that's our religion. You know, theistic conduct, be nice. Don't hurt people, be a good person, and live a moral life. And that's our religion. And there we do this, we don't do that, because it's... But what's the soul? And what, how does this bring liberation to the soul? Liberation from the bondage of misidentification with matter. How did it lead to realization of who we really are? So then we'll go to the Gyanis. So just a little, carrying on a little bit. The Gyanis' understanding of the soul is also very mixed up. They don't make a distinction, commonly, they don't make a distinction between the soul and the Supreme Soul. And if there is an idea of the Supreme Soul, it's merged with the Supreme Soul. That's what liberation is. Sayuja. But the eternal existence of the soul is something that just slips right through their fingers. So how do you live your life as a soul, conscious that you're a spirit soul, in a world of matter? How do you navigate that? It's bhakti. These are Krishna's energies. You use these energies in service to Krishna. And by that mood and the medium of service to Krishna, we can understand ourselves in Krishna. Because we're not separate from Krishna. Any understanding of self that's separate from Krishna is not, it's a misunderstanding, or at best, an incomplete understanding. So if you have an understanding of relationship with God, and you act that way, that's bhakti, and then truths about Krishna become revealed, or at least discernible. I mean, you're two educated young men doing whatever you do here in America, and you probably spent a whole lot of hours preparing your skill set to do what you're doing. You know, lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of sacrifices and hours to meet the standard of to do what you're doing. And then to match all of that with Krishna's pastime in Vrindavan, it's kind of like, huh? How does this fit? The paradigms don't match. But there's something about it, it's pious, and you know, there's some higher truth going on here. I don't really understand how they connect. So you kind of live in two worlds a bit. Spiritual reality world, and taking care of the duties of life world a bit. And straddle the two. But a life of bhakti evolves to the point where you see all those things that are temporary in relation to the source. And try strive to act that way in according to the regulations of sadhana bhakti. And then gradually, spiritual consciousness, like a seed sprouting, starts to awaken. And then you can see and experience things a little differently than you did before. You still carry on with duties, but you start to experience and feel things in a different way from a spiritual perspective, if it's done nicely, sadhana bhakti. And these pastimes of Krishna, that's the person whose name we're chanting, or the God who people of all over the world that are worshiping God, they're worshiping him. And here's what he looks like. And here's what he does. And here's his cleverness. And here's his different moods of loving dealings. And, you know, that's the person that people that worship God are worshiping. But there's his personality, his qualities, his form, his pastimes. We were a little digression, will come back. In Harinam Chintamani is a book by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. We just had the celebration for his appearance day. Sunday. Because Monday was in China. So Sunday, we had celebrated his appearance day. Today's Wednesday. So Bhaktivinoda wrote a book, Harinam Chintamani, one of his 100 books. And in the first chapter, he's dealing with, one of the topics he addresses is primary and secondary names, Mukhya Nam and Gauna Nam, Sanskrit terms. So primary names are names that indicate Krishna's pastimes and his relationships with his devotees. Like Gopal. That's a primary name. He protects cows. Yasoda Nandana and Nanda Nandana. Those names indicate Krishna in his relationships with his devotees. And those primary names have the potency to awaken love of God. And the secondary names, like Parameshwara and Adhoksaja and things like that, indicate the post or a quality, Atmarama. It's not the person with pastimes, it's, you know, Your Honor or Mr. President or Sir or something, you know, title. And there's somebody that occupies the post. And the somebody is the primary names. And then the post or the power or the quality is the secondary name. Secondary names give liberation. The primary names give love of God, which is beyond liberation. You can neutralize entanglement in reactions to sinful activities through the secondary names, like Vishnu Sahasranam. Many of the names are secondary. Some of them are primary. Here's some music. That is phone? Alarm. Time to get up, huh? Time to cook dinner or something? Okay. Just teasing you. So the pastimes of Krishna are his name. It's exactly how this commentary ends. Krish means to attract. So his pastimes attract. His name attracts and his pastimes attract. Although we're in this world and involved in all temporary things, and that's largely what material life is made up of, is involvement with temporary things. you know, with the idea of being successful or being an enjoyer or something. And then spiritual means to connect with things that are not temporary, but they're eternal. So the soul and the source of all souls and our relationship. That's the spiritual dimension in our life. So hearing his pastimes, it's kind of like, what's that? Because it's, you know, it's, it may in some ways sound like material, but it's not material. So it's puzzling because we're used to the material. It doesn't quite match the material. It's a little different. But by hearing the pastimes, there's a potency. And the potency awakens our spiritual consciousness. It cleanses the coverings, the contaminations on one side, and the other side it awakens higher consciousness or awareness of who we are in our relationship with Krishna. The potency is there in his pastimes, even if we don't understand them. And gradually by awakening bhakti, by hearing them, then we can start to understand more and more. Not just, you know, blind faith, okay, I'll just buy into this thing I can't understand and pretend like I understand it. But it's actually awakening of higher consciousness. That's the sadhana bhakti process. And the sadhana bhakti process done nicely leads to what these two things, cleansing and awakening. And it goes further, becomes an attraction, becomes a taste, becomes it's spontaneous ecstasy in relation to the spiritual dimension. And one can still go on, one is advised to still go on with the things of this world, but the consciousness changes. Sadhana bhakti, when it becomes matured, without skipping some details, it leads to a spontaneous devotional service, or raganuga bhakti. And when the standard of raganuga bhakti is, you won't even know that the person's on raganuga bhakti platform, because they're living their worldly life like everybody else. But internally, their consciousness is different. They're tuned into the Krishna channel, even while they're going through the things of responsible worldly life. That's when it's done properly. There's ways to do it improperly, but that's when it's done properly. That's where it leads to an awakening of cleansing and awakening. So let's see if there's some discussion on what we just read or whatever else. You start and then the others will follow. Go ahead. How many questions this evening? Two? Okay.
Thanks. Maharaj, in verse 29, it was mentioned about Kamsa becoming joyous through his spies. He came to know that Krishna was like swallowed. Does Kamsa already know by this time that Krishna is the person who is going to kill him, or
he deduces it? He doesn't know for sure, but he heard from This comes in Gopal Champu. Since he heard from Durga, the eighth child of Devaki has already taken birth, he has a suspicion. That's why he's sending demons. Even before, you know, before Narada comes to visit him And Narada confirms that little boy that you've been sending demons to kill, that's the eighth child of Devaki. So he had some idea, he wasn't certain.
So even the demons who are coming to kill Krishna, they also were not aware that this is the boy they were looking for.
They're just doing the orders of Kamsa. And they're envious by nature. And so, you know, go kill somebody, great. Got a job assignment, ready to go. Hired to kill.
Next question is regarding the mystic powers. We understand that Krishna is Yogeshwara.
Yeah.
That he is master of all mystics. And living entities can also attain some amount of mystic powers.
Yes.
So when it comes to some specific context of one of the mystic powers, let us say anima or something. So is it that, like when we say lighter than the lightest, is it that Krishna can become lighter than even that lightest or?
Yeah, that's what it means.
Okay. So yeah. There are gradations of,
gradations,
one.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. One more is regarding that Sahidya Mukti Maharaj.
Which one?
Sahidya Mukti. The soul considers that he is merging into the Supreme, but it really never happens. Like according to Brahma's statement also, they will come back to the material world.
Well, it merges into the light of the Supreme, which they consider to be the Supreme.
Okay. Is it because they don't have the understanding of the personality of Godhead?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Yes.
And those that are hankering for it and those that are speaking about it, and they don't know the personal feature. That the personal feature is concealed from those who are envious of the person.
And that is why they consider that they are already in the existence of the Lord.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you, Maharaj.
Okay.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. So my question was, like you mentioned about when someone is practicing spirituality and also working in a corporate world. So
yeah.
those are like two different worlds.
Two different.
Yeah. So like for someone who's still practicing, whose bhakti is shaky, that's even more like intimidating.
More which?
It's more intimidating.
Intimidating, okay.
And like sometimes...
Which side is intimidating, the corporate or the spiritual?
The combination of both. So you tend to lose ground of... sometimes it's like you are in this world or the other world.
Yeah.
And balancing act is a little double-edged sword. So
yeah.
How do we, as a practicing bhakta or as a sadhana bhakta, how do we reconcile both the worlds and still have that balance?
Your question is, I went the direction I went is just thinking of what you two must be going through. That is
kind of true what you mentioned.
Yeah. Okay. So immature, that's unadvised, is dump on one or dump on the other. And it's not uncommon that people are immature, you know, the beginning of spiritual life to like just trash this. Let's say somebody that's younger and they start to practice. Oh, I lost interest in school. And it's just immaturity. Or, you know, so how to balance is changing it's largely the target is to change the consciousness behind what you do, and not to change what you do. So that's, you know, it's subtle. Changing consciousness is subtle. It's not just like change of behavior. It's change the consciousness behind the behavior. So you can start with things that you do that's easier, like cooking. So there's a consciousness of cooking that's material and a consciousness of cooking that's Krishna conscious. So start in areas that are, you know, a little more clear, a little more like, you know, I can navigate that one. Maybe you cultivate and practice that one. And then other areas, you know, speech and how I regard other life forms and how I regard other people, other humans, but other life forms. So in areas that's doable, and you cultivate a spiritual conception doing those things and interacting with those things. And you're still in this, you know, two worlds place, the corporate and the spiritual activities part. But if you cultivate spiritual consciousness over here that's doable, it'll have its spin off or expand into the other areas. You'll start to get some realization just because the light's on a little brighter over there. And, you know, it depends on an individual, but one of the things that inspires people that to work in the corporate or the material paradigm is the fruits. That's what they're after. The fruits means I'm a success or a failure. So I want to be a success. And then when I'm success, I have some money and I use the money for enjoying my senses, you know, this way, that way, whatever people consider as enjoyment. So take some of those fruits and dedicate them to Krishna. That's karma yoga. And there's sakama and then there's nishkam karma yoga. You just do because it's, you want to do. I want my existence to become purified. Sakama is I do because, you know, I'm expecting something back. I want some perks. So this is this Bhagavad Gita that I'm discussing, but you apply yourself according to the teachings of Bhagavad Gita, then you can better navigate your way in that, the corporate part of your life. Then, you know, I want to be able to carry bhakti in my heart. So I can't give a Bhagavad Gita class in the workplace, but I can carry bhakti in my heart, so I can do things that are bhakti related, like distribute prasadam, or, you know, just be an exempt, to try my best to be an exemplary Vaishnava in the workplace where people don't know beans about Vaishnavism. But I want to be an example. I don't have to give a class on it. So you start to act in the consciousness of I'm an eternal servant of Krishna in the workplace. And, you know, you'll get realizations by trying to do that. You'll see your own shortcomings, but you'll also see the power of bhakti in helping you in many ways, like get answers to questions about some project or how to maintain evenness of temperament when people are doing what they do in the workplace sometimes, the backbiting and criticizing and fault finding. And, you know, so you just be an exemplary Vaishnava. So at least I'd like to carry that bhakti in my bhakti vessel in the workplace. And the rest starts to unfold. The consciousness changing dimension starts to unfold. And it starts with this little seed. And you'll get, you know, further and further and further understandings and realizations. Each person that goes, a little story. I mean, your question is one of the top five questions that sannyasis are asked. That's my experience. It's asked in different ways. But somebody asked me this that in New York so many years ago. I get the, you know, the morning and the evening. I don't get the 9-to-5 part. So how do I be Krishna conscious in the workplace? That was kind of like what the question was. And I said, I can give you some tips. But really what it comes down to is you try to be Krishna conscious in the workplace. You understand, I'm working for Krishna. Now, this was a devotee that was already practicing and they're really like reasonably well read and they had a foundation in bhakti teachings. So that my advice was, here's some tips, but really more important than the tips of this, that, and the other thing is the consciousness that the person, your supervisor thinks you're working for them because that's the way it works. And then they're working for their boss and they're working for their supervisor and, you know, and that's how the whole show runs. But you're working for Krishna. And you can act in a way that's respectful to this person thinks I'm working for them. But I know I'm working for Krishna. And that's okay. I can, you know, that's, you're not just in two worlds. You're in the workplace. But I'm in spiritual consciousness in the workplace where there's a different set of rules and expectations and all kinds of things. So this devotee did that. They just, one conversation, they did it for a month. They came back and said, I understand much better now that I'm working for Krishna. Because their work productivity went way up because they weren't just working for their supervisor, they're working for Krishna. And the supervisor noticed it. And they shared with me. Supervisor said, what happened to you? You know, we're over here stressed out over what's not going right. And I just come and ask you and you've got it all figured out. Just waiting for us to come and ask you. And then you're sitting there reading your book. And you're very peaceful. So what's going on? So it's being the Krishna conscious person in the workplace. You're working for Krishna. It's not easy. It's a consciousness transformation or elevation transformation. Isn't that, so there's some tips or some formulas or some do's and don'ts, but the essence is Krishna's part and parcel and you're trying to be connected to him, including that part of your life. A major part of your life. And it let it start as a seed and it let it grow. Okay? I think you have to put the speaker on.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. So my question was like, as a sadhaka, since we are beginning bhakti, So what are the pointers or milestones that we should look out for, which would help us to identify that we are indeed advancing in bhakti and okay. that we are on the right path?
Okay. Here's some real simple ones. Attraction for the temporary is subsiding. It's that litmus test. Milestones, as you said. So, an attraction for topics in relation to transcendence. Because topics in relation to transcendence don't tell you directly how to get ahead in the sense enjoyment program. It tells you how to connect more with who you are. So, attraction, Vishvaksena Kataruchi in Sanskrit. Attraction for the topics of the personality of Godhead. And a gradual diminishing of the contemplations of being a material enjoyer and being around objects that look like enjoyment and end up being misery. But that's just, you know, that's a strong one. The qualities of goodness, are increasing and the qualities of passion, ignorance are decreasing. Goodness, cleanliness, regulation of your habits, truthfulness, no duplicity, you know, in your dealings with others, a desire to control the mind and senses, a capacity to control the mind and senses. So modes of goodness, charity, compassion. You're thinking about how something is going to impact other people when you do or say something. Mode of goodness is increasing. The other modes are decreasing. Those are some standards. There's all, in the preliminary stage, expect unsteadiness because just that's standard. So don't, you know, berate or beat yourself up or something or become discouraged. It's just unsteadiness is part of the beginning stage. And strive for steadiness, looking towards. Then another, I would say, milestone is here's where I am. And I being honest with myself, this is where I am. And I have some idea of this longer distance goal. And with some guidance, here's a little step I can take towards that goal. And then you stay with it. A little step that you stay with. Those are some tips.
So this question is from Sashimukhi Mataji from Houston. This has been on my mind for a while now, and I haven't been able to understand this aspect of Kaliya pastime. Kaliya chose Yamuna to hide himself from Garuda out of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And he came and poisoned the waters of Yamuna, and Yamuna Devi underwent a lot of pain and suffering. So my question is, why does Yamuna Devi have to tolerate all this? Is this because of her mood of service to Lord Hari that she tolerates, or some kind of curse that she received?
No, not a curse. She's a mother. And Shashimukhi, you're a mother. And you tolerate lots of things as a mother. And you smile. Is it due to some curse that you got that you became a mother? And you had dependents who would sometimes behave not so nicely and sometimes behave nicely, and it's just part of being a mother. So Mother Yamuna is a mother. And sometimes. But she smiles. Krishna came to the rescue.
So there was just one last part. So why does a pure devotee like Yamuna Devi have to do these?
Wait, that's addressed. Okay.
Then Sanchari's question. When you were speaking about the glee that the demons felt when Krishna stepped into the mouth of Agasura,
mm-hmm.
I was thinking about the modern day atheists and how much joy they have when a religious personality falls down or stops practicing. Especially thinking about the early Hare Krishna movement. To my understanding, the demons were envious of Krishna, but they also had the understanding begrudgingly or unwillingly that he is God. With the modern day atheists, what are they envious of if they are their premise is they don't believe in God? How do we understand their driving force?
Well, there's different ways of answering that, but one way is, although they say bad things about God, their consciousness is on Him. And no, there is no God, or God is bad, or something, something, something. But their consciousness is going to him because he's all attractive, and he's attracting their envy. So what the driving force is, enmity. It's a dark, it's a mode of ignorance, emotion, or motivator. But that's what's driving them. They want to be enjoyers, and there's an obstacle. So they're envious. That's what's driving them. It's a perverted sense of enjoyment.
This is Amara Mataji's question. Does consciousness translate or reflect into an activity, or the activities can also just be behavior?
I'm not sure what she means by that, because you can't delete consciousness from behavior. There's no such thing. So it's the first of the two options. Next. Okay. Looks like we're done. You anything follow up? No? Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.